So, what I want to do with you today is a lot of text. Let's just dive into the Zohar, and I think you're ready. It's the last session, and I'm happy to have no introduction. I was coming by bus, and I was like, yeah, I don't need to do any kind of an introduction. We can dive into the Zohar. This is what I love, and, you know, let the Zohar speak for itself. So, what I wanted to do is to finish the awakening to the Torah. Remember the story we learned? And we were in the middle of it. And some of you jumped to the end. I remember exactly who. And but really, I teach slowly. And I believe that if you want to open into the secret of the Zohar, so we need to kind of open slowly. And what we can do is we'll have some Bibles.
Bibles. Every time I hear that word, it's kind of weird. A rash when they hear the word.
Let's hear.
I can do that also.
Why am I bringing the Bible in? Because I remember I told you that the Zohar is actually interpretation for the Torah. Mm-hmm. And it will always try to understand the Torah. And we, to the people who were here, we were reading the text from Truma, from Vayakhel, actually, about the Truma. I think you were not here. Were you here in this last class?
No, it was
before that. So this story is located in a very, very special parasha, in Parashat Ki Tissa, Exodus 30. Lamedina, so this three, so open it for a minute.
What are the numbers?
Yeah,
what's 33?
Kitissa is, Kitissa is from, Kitissa is from, it's actually from 30. To
you're talking about the whole parasha, or what?
It's about the whole parasha, but especially where I start by Akel. It's from 30 to 35, this parasha, and it talks about
Kitissa
in Exodus, and it talks about Moses coming down from heaven, and from the mountain, not from heaven, from the mountain of Sinai, and see the golden calf, and breaking the tablets. And on 33, we have a very, very, very important.
Where?
On 33, we have a very, very, very important, very famous conversation between Moses and God. So if somebody is willing to read for us from verse 12 to 23.
Well, 33, 12.
So go ahead, let's from 12 to 30, from 12. Exodus 33 from Pasuk Shorot, from Pasuk 12. כן, מפסוק 12 לפסוק, כן, from 12 to 23.
אוקיי,
יאללה.
אוקיי, בסדר.
And Moshe said to the Lord, "See, thou sayest to me, bring up this people, but thou hast not let me know whom thou wilt send for me. Yet thou hast said, I know thee by name, and thou hast also found favor in my sight. Now therefore I pray thee, if I have found favor in thy sight, show me now thy way, that I may know thee, that I may find favor in thy sight. Consider that this nation is thy people." And he said, "My presence shall go with thee, and I will give thee rest." And he said to him, "If thy presence go not with me, carry us not from here. For in what shall it be known here that I and thy people have found favor in thy sight? It is not in that thou goest with us. So shall we be differentiated, I and thy people, all the people that are upon the face of the earth?" And the Lord said to Moshe, "I will do this thing also that thou hast spoken, for thou hast found favor in my sight, and I know thee by name." And he said, "I pray thee, show me the glory." And he said, "I will make
you..." Wow, I'm listening to you, and it's like nothing like the Hebrew.
No.
Because not the power. Literally, like I need words to show what I want to show, and it's like nothing. Continue, but it's like help us nothing.
Crazy.
Yeah.
So a lot of it's play on Hebrew meanings of words.
Like just the word glory has nothing to do with here.
What is it in Hebrew?
Right. Yeah.
Thy glory is not
for them. I'm not sure.
You wouldn't translate it to your honor.
Continue and we'll see that.
Okay, and he said, "I pray thee, show me thy glory." And he said, "I will make all my goodness pass before thee, and I will proclaim the name of the Lord before thee, and will be gracious to whom I will be gracious. I will show mercy on whom I will show mercy." And he said, "Thou canst not see my face, for no man shall see me and live." And the Lord said, "Behold, there is a place for me, and thou shalt stand upon a rock, and it shall come to pass, while my glory is passed by, I will put thee in a cleft of the rock, and will cover thee with my hand while I pass by. And I will take away my hand, and thou shalt see my back, for my face shall not be seen." It's very uncomfortable to read as well. It's not a flowing text.
So how many of you feel comfortable with the Hebrew?
Well, if you go slow enough,
for sure.
It's much nicer.
In the Hebrew? Yeah. Not only it's nicer, we need the Hebrew in order to understand.
So to understand
the way that the Zohar thinks about it. So somebody is feeling comfortable to read the Hebrew, and then we'll follow the English. Like, I'm sorry. I thought that I'm only with the Hebrew, so I thought the translation would be pretty parallel.
No,
Vayomer Moshe.
Go ahead. Yes, sir.
You want me to read it?
Yes,
okay. Vayomer Moshe el Adonai.
Okay,
I'll read it.
ויאמר
משה אל אדוני, ראה אתה אומר אליי, העל את העם הזה, ואתה לא הודעתני את אשר תשלח עמי. ואתה אמרת, ידיעתיך בשם, וגם מצאת חן בעיניי. ואתה, אם נמצאתי חן בעיניך, הודיעני נא את דרכך ועדאיך, למען אמצא חן בעיניך, וראה כי עמך הגוי הזה. ויאמר, פניי ילכו, והניחותי לך. ויאמר אליו, אם אין פניך הולכים, אל תעלם מזה. ובמה יוודא אפוא כי מצאתי חן בעיניך אני ועמך? הלא בלכתך עמנו ונפלנו אני ועמך מכל העם אשר על פני האדמה. ויאמר אדוני אל משה, גם את הדבר הזה אשר דיברת אעשה, כי מצאת חן בעיניי ואדעך בשם. ויאמר, הראני נא את כבודך. ויאמר, אני אעביר כל טובי על פניך, וקראתי בשם אדוני לפניך, וחנותי את אשר אחון, וריחמתי את אשר ארחם. ויאמר, לא תוכל לראות את פניי, כי לא יראני האדם וחי. ויאמר אדוני, הנה מקום איתי וניצבת על הצור. והיה בעבור כבודי ושמתיך בנקרת הצור, וסקותי כפי עליך עד עוברי, והסירותי את כפי וראית את אחוריי ופניי לא יראו.
It's one of the most, I'll show why it's very important in the Hebrew, but it's one of the most, I think, important conversation in the Bible between man and God. Which asks a very, very important question. What can we really know about God? How can we meet God? What kind of interaction of what we were talking a lot about, with the loot revolution, what can be there? Because, right, and what the purpose of it? Moses tells God, I want to see Kvodecha, which I don't know if it's glory. Kvod...
What is it? Kvodecha?
We have few. I don't know if we can actually translate it to English.
See your Majesty.
Yes.
I don't know.
I don't. Why is not honor? Sorry, your glory not appropriate. I think it's a good translation.
Why?
I think it is.
Where did that the word glory come from?
Well, if you go to an important person who you're speaking to, you would say to them, Mashlom Kvodcha, Mashlom Kvodecha, which essentially is an honorific title, translation. You would say that to a king, to something of a...
What is to glory in English?
To glory, there is no word.
There's no word
to glory. To glorify is honorable.
Give honor to.
Yeah.
Yeah. Majesty gives you a slightly different interpretation.
Yeah, Majesty could, yeah. See your Majesty?
No, yes, that's no, not your Majesty.
No, he's saying that maybe Majesty's a better translation.
Oh, no, maybe your Majesty is a beautiful translation.
Yes.
You see your Majesty? Yes, your greatness. Which is glory. Which is glory.
And your great glory is the translation.
I don't see what's wrong with glory either.
In your great Majesty, I would say. I
don't know enough about English, but also in Hebrew, we don't know exactly what does that mean, kavod.
Oh.
We get the...
We know that we have kavod in kibudowin. What does that mean? Is that to respect, is that to obey, to honor? What does that really mean? We know that there is tension between kaved and kavod, because we know that there is kiseh kavod, which means that it's supposed to hold.
Right.
Presence. So,
just the presence.
I just have a question. If this is also a translation into the Hebrew, which obviously it is, from Aramaic, what is the purpose of dealing with the literal translation of the word in Hebrew when that's, I mean, it could just as easily have been translated from the Aramaic to the English. I mean, it just went to the Hebrew in the interim.
The Bible was written in Hebrew, not in Aramaic.
The Bible was written in Hebrew.
It was the Zohar that was written in Hebrew. I asked. Oh, it's written in Hebrew and those are the words.
Yeah.
These are the words of the Bible.
Okay.
And that's a translation. This is a translation.
A direct translation of the
original. Of the Hebrew, whether it's accurate or not.
Well, no, that's
not true. I
made a mistake. Sorry.
Yeah, okay.
It was the Zohar.
The Zohar is
The Zohar is written in Aramaic and it's inspired the big love of the love of the Zohar is the Torah. And the way that the Zohar reads the Torah, that he really tried to understand the words. Really, really, really tried to understand the words. What does that mean to respect? Mazakavod. What is it? What is it? And the method of this literature is to zoom in into a word and to really try to understand. But I
don't. No, I understand. My original assumption was.
Yeah. So. But I'm just. I'm. But what is actually not what I'm trying to really. What is just an example that Moses asked to see. Show me your glory or
to,
your.
When we speak to the emotional soul, how do you address it? For Oshinusha or for the sun. So basically, it's what we said, we're honoring the difference between that figure and the rest of us, as simple people, peasants. So, Fod is a very respectful word. It's about as respectful as you can get.
Yeah. So, Pshat will go with you, with Kavod is just,
okay,
you know,
no,
a respect.
Holy Pshat.
Yeah, but it's a, but we know that it's a very loaded word, because okay. What does that mean to lechabed et ha'orei shelcha? Is it only to honor him, like because he's in a harach, or do you need to understand really?
What did you just refer to?
But you know what, I don't really...
Kabed
et avicha ve'et imecha. What does that mean, to respect them?
No, it means to honor.
Or to honor them.
But kavod... Read them differently.
Put a program in kavod, because go and Google and check the word kavod in the Bible and see how many interpretations they put it. What does that really mean, have any night vodecha, is it? To show me your glory or to really show me your essence. They put all kind of understanding.
Essence.
To what does that mean, Mahut of Kavod? But what I really want to show you here, that they're really want to, the word panim,
what?
Panim, the word panim, face, is keep showing it here, it's repeating itself. It tells him, you can look at verse, actually go even to verse 11, that V'diber Adonai el Moshe panim el panim, it tells him that they speak face to face, and then it tells him, you can see my face. See my face.
Right.
And then he tells him, at verse 14, Panai el Chu, you know, I will, my face will go with you, right?
Mm-hmm.
And I will hanichoti lecha, and he tells him, if your face are not coming with me, don't even bother to take us to Al Talen, don't take us to Israel. So they really have the word face, panim, is really, really, really. It might be in a minute. It might be, but the word panim.
So Moshe was making demands. And Elohim decided he would give in, but only up to a point. You'll be able to see my back. It's interesting that Moshe was able to put pressure on God.
All the heroes in the Bible.
And God, what?
All the heroes in the Bible.
Okay, he was able to put pressure on God. If you really think that I'm, if you know my name and remember, this is your people, and if you want them to do what you want them to do, then you've got to come across for us and show me your face. And God says, okay, well, then I can't show you, because if I show you, I'll have to kill you. So, not bad. You'll see my back.
So we have, right, we have a dialogue between...
Negotiation
between seeing my face and not seeing my face. Seeing my face...
It's representing a deeper sin here. It's representing... That's the story. But it's really saying... You can't say anything about God. You can't limit him to a word. You can't see its face. You can't even see his essence. It's beyond words. You can't give it a word.
Beyond experience.
You can't give it a name. You can't limit it by saying it's glorious, it's majestic. The sunsets are glorious. You know, the mountains are majestic. God is beyond, I think.
Beyond description.
Yes, beyond description. So it's representing a much bigger problem, not just the technical problem that God is saying to Moshe, screw you, Moshe, and we'll see my back. You know, it's not giving a moon.
Right, so we have the ending of it is Panai lo yira'u, my face, you cannot see my face. Right? You will always see.
Cannot or will not?
Will not be seen.
Will not be seen. Will not be seen. What's the difference between?
There's a little difference between you can't see my face and my face
will not be seen.
Not be seen. Will not be seen, cannot be seen.
So here we have a question if God has a face, right?
God doesn't take Moshe's critique or demand. He said, is a limit.
Yeah,
I'll show you my back, but my face can never be seen.
That's what he's saying. I think a problem.
But before that, we do know, like, they tell us that they spoke face to face.
Which is interesting.
And that he tells him, Panayelchu, my face will go. And then he tells him, no, right? Okay, because you're right, Moses keep pushing, okay, show me. But you're already speaking face to face. And then God says, Panay. Right, you will not see my face. And of course, in Hebrew we have, you know, that the Bible was not how do you say menukad?
How do you say what?
Menukad, without vowels.
Without
the dots?
Yes.
No, there's a bigger problem.
Until
the Bible,
there
is,
right.
The vowels,
we have few, you can check it. Some say you that until
vowels.
Without the nekudot.
Yes.
some say until So some say until the 3rd century, some say till 10th century. It was a process of putting the dots between the 3rd century to the 10th century, which means that the way we read it today with the doesn't have, it's not necessarily how it was meant. And in the word panim, it's really important because we don't know if it's between.
Well, that's what you said.
And
My internality.
Or panim.
My essence.
It's my internality.
And panim.
Okay.
Or panim. And panim. We don't know what they meant. We don't know this.
Yes. All you know is that the donor that put in there itself is an
answer. Yeah, but it says as a man.
It says itself is a kibush. In other words, whoever put those, the Masoretes, whoever put those
Nekudot
in,
of course,
were giving it
exactly
right. And it would be read as panim, not panim.
That was a commentary.
Somebody showed that it would be panim el panim,
but it says here,
and thou shalt see my back.
Kasher yidaber ish el rehu, like a person speaks to a friend.
Hey, so I can speak from my inner,
telepathy.
It's not so simple to say that God has face. Also, we know that so many times God tells us, "I have no shape." So it's not also not so literally to say panim el panim. What does that mean? Why not panim el panim?
He also says, "I have no
name." In many ways, it makes more sense.
Yeah, but maybe it was a panim and a panim means not through an interlocutor, not through something, but in a very direct way.
It could be. I'm just open to possibilities of how can you play with it. And I encourage you, this is something that I do with my students all the time. I ask them in the secular yeshiva when I teach Bible, sometimes only the Bible, so I ask them to play with the dots. Mm-hmm. To see if you have different ways to read the Torah. I'll show you one example. For example, in Leviticus 19, it says, "Ve'al tekalel cheresh, lifnei iver lo tasim michshol." Don't put before a blind man a stumbling block, and don't curse a deaf man. Lo tekalel cheresh. But it could be also lo tekalel cheresh. Don't curse silently. If you do that, you know, let the person hear you. And we don't know if it's cheresh or cheresh. Both of them can really work. So play.
You just hit something very important. We're seeing everything through a filter, and we can't unremember these thoughts.
Of course.
We are reading in English, so we're seeing it through a tertiary.
Yeah,
of course. interpretation.
So, yeah, of course. But also when you read in Hebrew, play with the dots. This is what my, it's not me, it's my teachers. My teachers taught me that, to play with that.
But people who observed the Inbet Torah decided that these were the way that the Kodosh should be read. So,
yeah, but who says they're right?
But somebody made a decision.
Well, who said that whoever wrote this really meant this? Who knows? I mean, this is not...
It's meant by the same token. Who said this is the word of God? Maybe it was one person wrote it, this one, and another person wrote that one. They say that by...
But you know, Sharon, the way that we see it, that it was... it was a matter for conflict. What were the dots? We have one translation to Aramaic from the 3rd century. It's called Targum Onkelos. The translation of Onkelos. And we see Onkelos. And we see sometimes that he translated by dots that were different from ours, from our interpretation. So interpretation also has to do a lot with... people who read it that way, and it's a way mitkabeh, it's become that way. I don't know if it's really, you know, gdolim b'Torah. It's something that became the more dominant interpretation. But for us, playing with it doesn't mean that we need to break it. It can expand it. For me, it's just a matter of expansion. Panim el panim and pnim el pnim. It's a very interesting way to try to understand. To understand that, and why am I pushing you, talking to you about Len?
I believe we're talking about belief here, and about the fact that actually you'll never see God until the final chapter. Therefore, you're not going to see Him. You're talking to Him, but you're not seeing Him. It brings to mind somewhere, either Luke or John or whatever, when Christ is crucified, he speaks about to Thomas, doubting Thomas, because Thomas doubted that the man who was in front of him was in fact a risen Christ. Again, it's about belief. And he said, you know, how can other people believe if they haven't had the same opportunity of seeing me as you know? The only one that actually would have the belief that of sight will be Moses. Parallel between the fact that God is the unseen. You are believing in something that is majestic and you cannot see His face, because if you did, the belief will be destroyed.
You talk of like what we talked last week about the secret. If God will, if Moses will really see God, right? So maybe the secret will be over. You see God, you humanize Him.
Yeah, but not at that point. Because at that point, Moses was in trouble. He had all these unruly people who would never believe him unless he had something to prove. And he said, how will we be different than if we are your people? How will we be different than any other people if you're not with us? And help us to and watch over us and everything. He's now having to deal with these people who don't believe. So it's not a question of, well, it's secret, accepted secret. He really needs proof, because this is the time when the people are being formed as people. Secret doesn't work in this place.
You write that it's also, if we read it on the understanding that they already made a golden calf, and he wants to see something. If we will read it really as a panim, he wants something visual. Okay, so show me who are you, because you know this is what. But what God gives him is nothing of what he asked, right? What he gives him later on will be the 12th, the 13 midot, Adonai, Adonai, Elachul, Vechanun, right? He doesn't get any face. He gets all kind of ways that God expresses itself in the world.
That he was in trouble when you think about it, because he brought these people out of Egypt. And he was stuck with them in the desert, and they were rising up. And he was saying, I don't know who this guy is. You know, I don't know who this guy is, and I don't know if I can trust him. And if I if I am your person, then prove to me that you're going to be with me, because it's going to be very hard.
Right, and right, and it, and the more that it goes on and on, it's getting more and more abstract. And God doesn't give him the right amount of Sinai, and what he gave him there with all the, you know, Ashan, with the smells and with everything, that was pretty visual, right? And they didn't believe him, and they built the golden calf. And more, we actually go in that he goes to Pnim El Pnim, and not to Panim El Panim. That he goes to give him all kind of expressions of God and philosophical ideas about Chesed, about and God doesn't show anymore. We don't have Mount Sinai anymore like that. We actually having more and more very delicate expressions.
So it's internal,
becoming more and more internal.
Intimately, that's your relationship is intimate.
Right.
Panim.
Right, this is also why I'm pushing it to whether it's Panim.
Listen to this. Does Moshe ever speak to God, Panim El Panim? I think that's not what the text is saying. I think the text is saying, unlike other faiths and religions, you can make physical images of God and give him physical characteristics. This God, and this is maybe the essence of this whole thing, doesn't do that. His essence is not available to you ever. And that's the lesson for all history. And you're going to have to deal with the fact that you can't see me. And if you can't see me, then you've got to accept that. There's no substitute for that reality. Golden calves don't work.
So
nothing else works.
So no Pnim and no Panim, you say, actually.
I'm saying, no Pnim or no Panim.
No, but
he heard him.
What about, did he hear him? Did Moshe hear God's voice? Because we don't know if he
heard. Moshe is in a struggle because he wanted a symbol. He wanted physical.
I know, but they're talking.
So they're talking. He said, I can never sell you unless you give me something physical.
What I'm saying is that it doesn't say that he didn't hear God's voice. He said he didn't see his face, and it said that he saw his back. He got a lot more, but he didn't get what he wanted.
And that is the ultimate statement of Jesus. That the ultimate statement is you'll never get to see me or know me. You may know a little bit about my mirror, but you'll never, ever get to the essence. And Moshe had to accept that. That's all he could ever get.
I think it's a lot. I mean, it's not like, you know, just a statue.
If
we will move on a little bit more, and we'll go to chapter 34, verse 26.
34
in this, and soon you will see why I took you to the Bible. If you go to, is it okay that I'll read it in Hebrew and
you will follow in
the English? Is that okay with everybody?
Yes.
Okay, so
where does it begin?
We go in 31.
34, verse 26.
Yeah. And this is after on what happened in the beginning of this chapter, that God is passing on the face of Moses. Right. So, but before that, God is passing on the face of Moses, and he gives him and he tells him, Adonai, Adonai, Lachu Mechanun. This is why we read what we read on Yom Kippur. And it's very, very meaningful. And then Moses goes back to be intimate with God. And we see, I'm on chapter 34, 27.
27.
27.
Yeah. Okay.
Yes. Vayomer Adonai El Moshe, כתוב לך את הדברים האלה, כי על פי הדברים האלה קראתי איתך ברית ואת ישראל. Are you with me? ויהי שם עם אדוני 40 יום ו-40 לילה. לחם לא אכל ומים לא שתה, ויכתוב על הלוחות את דברי הברית עשרת הדברים. ויהי ברדת משה מהר סיני, ושני לוחות העדות ביד משה, ברידתו מנהר, ומשה לא ידע כי קרן אור פניו, ודברו איתו. וירא אהרון וכל בני ישראל את משה, והנה קרן אור פניו. ויראו מגשת אליו. ויקרא אליהם משה, וישובו אליו אהרון וכל הנשיאים בעדה, וידבר משה אליהם. ואחרי כן ניגשו כל בני ישראל, ויצבם את כל אשר דיבר אדוני איתו בהר סיני, ויכל משה מדבר איתם, ויתן על פניו מסווה. ובבוא משה לפני אדוני לדבר איתו, יסיר את המסווה עד סתו, ויצא ודיבר אל בני ישראל את אשר יצווה. וראו בני ישראל את פני משה, כי קרן אור פני משה, והשיב משה את המסווה על פניו, עד בואו לדבר איתו. יא.
יש משמעות, is there a significance? זה של דיברות, אבל זה דברים.
Where do you see it?
לא,
זה... כי על פי הדברים האלה.
בסדר דברים?
Yeah, it's interesting. I would probably...
If you were 40 days in the desert, 40 days and 40 nights, so no food and no drink, you would also come off the mountain with your skin tied across your face and shining, because it means white as anything.
I'm not talking about that. I'm talking about something. No, no. You know the word you brought,
yeah.
Which I thought, I noticed it. First time I noticed in my life, it's just funny.
That's a question.
What verse are you on?
Yeah.
Just
yeah. It's interesting, but it's, I have no answer here.
No, well, the reason I'm asking, because it relates to what we did before, without the Nikudot, there's a double and a triple and a quadruple and a quintuple meaning, a meaning with a meaning, and you're never going to get the meaning. It's like a virtual onion.
Right, rebuild.
It's never ending.
Right.
It's an infinite onion.
Not infinite, but it's multiply understanding. Because you do have letters. But
what,
yeah.
What if that gives you a wiggle room? All of those onion peels. In other words, for your time and place, you need to find a meaning in the door.
Yes.
So not every peel is going to be useful for you.
Yes.
You somehow find the one that's right, and then you know that that's not going to be right for the next one.
Yes.
Right. We know also that if you read the Mahabharata, you know the holy scriptures of the Indians,
yep.
So of the Hindu, not the Indians, the Hindu culture, the Mahabharata, so it's been written in a very interesting way that it's a lot of letters that are undivided to words, and the way that you divide it, you actually you decide the words.
Oh, so you're
and
creating it.
You're creating it, and it's a commentary, and yeah. And you see that when you read, I also, my first degree was in studying religion.
Comparative religion.
So you see that the way that people divided the Mahabharata gave different interpretation to it, and it worked. It worked in different ways. You really see how they, when you read Sanskrit, you see it. But it works. So it's very, very interesting with holy scriptures, how it works with different meanings.
And that's a good way to go panim inside, because you have to bring out from inside.
From yourself.
Mm-hmm. What's important. But you have the tradition to help you.
Right. And the person who wrote a lot about it, and I love his book, I actually have it with me. Because I taught it today. I think I have it with me. I hope I have it with me. Is Art Green.
Oh.
Do you know this in English? It's a very, very, very important book in my Bakshu Panai, apropos, Stick My Face, Call My Name. You know this book?
I know Art Green.
Art Green wrote this small theological It's in English. This is a translation.
Yeah. What was it called?
What's it called in English?
I think that in English it's seek my face, speak my name.
What's the
first?
Seek my face. See my name.
This is so he talks a lot about this padim and pnim and the tension between it and Mount Sinai. But here we see also that Moses having the same issue like God with his people. Is it okay?
Mm-hmm. Oh. You gotta get off.
Yeah. That God, that Moses needs to cover, that is covering his face and not showing his face, and only on, in some way between God and himself he can uncover the cover, but between him and his people he needs to put the cover, and they can't really see him because he is glorified, he's glowing and
glowing.
So in this we see that in this small parasha, Kitisa portion, we have something that deals a lot with seeing face, covering face, how much of our face we can show, Moses can show, God can show. And now what we're going, when we'll go into the Zohar, if you remember also the story, if you remember what we were doing, they're also asking him the question of revealing. Mm-hmm. How can we really reveal the Torah? Mm-hmm. Can we really see the Torah? How can we see the Torah? How much of the Torah we can see?
So could you say that for chesed, for chachma, that this is almost in a sense the complete outpouring of this kind of identifiable energy, and the gevura and the bina, they're almost the veils that are needed in order to be able to
interesting,
to,
beautiful,
to appreciate that kind of specific kind of energy, specific kind of the wisdom. And in order to be able to get the wisdom, you need to have it. It's too old. Sometimes you have an example. Sometimes you see somebody who's so amazingly enthusiastic, because there's they're coming from a very deep internal place. And sometimes the people back up because it's just too much for them to handle. And you almost like want to tell them to kind of close down a little in order to be able to.
Yeah.
I mean, it's not, we do have those experiences here. Maybe not, if, you know, that certainly through drugs is.
Your internal reference is to these drugs.
Well, because it actually, I must admit that having taken LSD and a number of times, that you actually get to sometimes, because. Chemically, everything becomes so intense and so unveiled, so to speak, that you actually walk around. You can have an experience of feeling completely open and unveiled, and it, sometimes to the point of being so, in the sense, vulnerable to everything that's around you, outside of you.
Overwhelmed.
So. Sometimes when you're in that state, you almost have to you realize that you, in order to interact with other people, you have to kind of close down slightly, because first of all, it's too scary for other people, the energy, and also in order to communicate, you have to come back to a place where you're able to share with somebody who can understand it.
That's like a mystical experience.
And here we have, I think, an interesting relationship between Pnim and panim, that sometimes we need the panim in order to back us up.
So it may mean the same thing simultaneously.
It may mean that will be the beauty of it, like what you said, Lynn, about the double meaning, that both can work and needs to work.
It's yeah. the use of masks in many cultures.
Right.
But you have a pnim, you have your face, but your face many times tells what's inside.
Like, or not.
But then you put on a mask. And they did it in Renaissance Italy, they do it in Africa, they do it in many places, in different cultures. The mask of the panim and the pnim.
Right.
It's a very interesting.
Yeah, I tried to make it for myself, trying to make a distinction between seeing the face of God or not seeing the face of God. And there's always a tendency to say that you can't hardly see. You can't hardly see the face of Torah, which is very different, because I think that you can't see the face of God, as I understand what Yahadut says to us, but I think we can. The essence of Jewish life is to try and understand and to get inside what it says in the Torah. Those are two very different things. The one's available to us and occurs, and the other is not available to and completely discouraged.
Yeah.
But it says that she does reveal herself.
It does reveal itself and keep covering. So if we'll go.
She does reveal herself.
That's what I just said.
She reveals and conceals.
Right. Why did I take you to this chapter? Besides that, I really love it, and I could, stop the Zohar and talks about that. The whole, talks learn it because I think it's so important. But I wanted to put the tension between revealing and hiding, and the fact that we have all the time the quest to keep searching. Moses is keep searching for God. And we have this, keep searching for an inner meaning in the Torah, in the Zohar. The fact that the Torah keeps, having more and more faces.
Right.
Shivim panim, the Torah, or shivim pnimim.
What is hester panim? How does that fit into this picture? Hester panim is the hidden face.
Yes.
Right.
And it's the hidden face of God? Is that what it refers to?
Maybe. Or the fact that we are not panim el panim with what's going on here, but we have 1 hour now, so I want really to dive into the. We took a whole 1 hour to understand that, but now we can see that how much Zohar is inspired by the Persian. This is his interpretation to Kitisa. In Kitisa, it's about Moses and God, but for him, Mount Sinai, on the way that if you remember that he said that Bat Kol Yoset Nahar Korev, that there is a voice of God coming out from Mount Korev every day and calling with love to us to back up and to back our face to it. And where do we find it? In the Torah. Our way to be with the revolution, to be in Igalut, is to study the Torah, but the Torah is a living thing. It's not only a text, it's an existence, and it's more than text, and we really have to be in a full encounter with it. Ki etz chayim, it's really something that has to be bigger, and we have this relationship of being panim el panim, being face to face to it, and not being exposed to the mystery and not all the time of it. So let's read together the parable, from the parable, and start. We're going back to the text. You know what, let's read from human beings, just that we will remember what we read, and we will stop when, I think I know where we stopped. So who is going to read human beings?
Human beings are so confused in their minds. They do not see the way of truth in Torah. Torah comes out to them every day in love, but they do not want to turn their heads. Even though I said that Torah removes the word from her sheath, is seen for a moment, then quickly hides away, that is certainly true. But when she reveals herself from her sheath and hides herself right away, she does so only for those who know her intimately. A parable, to what can this be compared? To a beloved, who is beautiful in every way, and hidden deep within her palace. She has one lover, unknown to anyone. He is hidden too. Out of his love of her, this lover passes by her gate constantly, lifting his eyes to see to every side. She knows that her lover is hovering about her gate constantly. What does she do? She opens a little window in her hidden palace and reveals her face to her lover, and then swiftly withdraws, concealing herself. No one near her lover sees or reflects, only the lover. And his heart and his soul and everything within him flow after her. And he knows that out of love for him, she reveals herself to him for that one moment to awaken love in him.
So remember, we talked a lot about the game, right? The game of temptation, of the game of and some of you were a little bit mad at her. What is she doing? Why can't she just show her face? And right? And we talked about it. What do we have? What do we gain when we have revealing and hiding, and the power of erotic power of you know, of searching, and what do we have in that? And the fact that she wants to awake Torah, to awake the love in him, right? That she knows that she, out of her love, he knows that out of love for him, she does it, the game of it, of hiding and concealing.
And he for her.
And
well.
Revealing,
yeah,
right?
And he for her as well.
No doubt.
So he keeps walking.
That's
around.
What keeps.
He keeps looking out there.
That's what
he lets it be known that he's out there.
Yes.
Right. Yeah.
But this is the paradox of Torah study. This is the paradox of Torah study. To study means to analyze. When you analyze, you have necessity to break it down into aggregate parts. This means this, this means that. And the minute you break a whole thing down into aggregate parts, you desiccate it, you dry it up, you lose its fullness. So that's, it's revealing a little bit, but you have to, in other words, there's a paradox to study.
I don't think your study is fair. I don't think your definition of study is fair.
It's one of the definitions.
The study, as you've described it, is a purely intellectual, rational process of breaking things down into their
analysis.
Okay, but it depends on how you approach the study.
I agree.
And so that's really has it.
Okay, let me make my final point.
You're going to make a final point?
No.
Finally.
I think maybe that the Zohar tradition, the Kabbalistic tradition, is sort of an antidote to the Talmudic tradition of too much particular, and just sort of just breathe it in and get it, and don't try to understand it totally. And just by getting it and not trying to understand it totally, you'll understand it at a whole different level.
Wow, he's going mystical on us.
No, he's talking about intuitive.
Well, that's great, yes. Because it's more interesting.
Yeah, but Sharon is challenged by my slow pace.
Yes.
Yeah, but it's okay.
But that's the longing to find what the hell's going on.
You're right. I think you're right. You're right about, in my opinion, you're right. And in the book, I recommended you Melila's book about the Zohar. She talks about the difference of composing the homiletic in the Zohar to the Talmud. That in the Talmud is really what we call Shakla and Talia, which means I will say something like that, and then I'll show you that what you said is not true or not necessarily the truth, and we will, you know, try to all the time open the method by negotiating or lachlok. But in the Zohar it's different. Somebody will say an interpretation to one verse, and the other one who wants to say something else will not show the other person that it's not right, but on a very deep level he said yes, and
Or yes, but.
Instead of yes,
he will not yes, but.
Yes, and.
He says that in ads.
Yeah, but not politically correct, yes, and. But really, I'll take what you said, and I will reveal another
way,
another meaning, and build in the way that if we will
work.
Sorry.
Sorry.
Yeah. Me? I hope you didn't take your
job.
I need a
but this is really important because... If we will try to grow it,
yeah.
So if you study sometime, if you study Talmud with someone who is very analytic, he will write it like that. You will, I will give something, and I'll show you that this is not true, and then I'll give another assumption. And then we'll see that it's not true. And then I'll give you another assumption and I'll show you that it's not true. And then there is some kind of assumption that nobody is been able
to disprove.
To disprove. And that will be it. But if you will see how it's been written in the Zohar, if you try to analyze it,
yes.
It will be like that.
Yes.
It is.
Oh, it will be like that. Somebody will give an interpretation. The other one will take it and will go and will say, I have another, this is right. And I have another meaning. But usually the other one who will talk after it will go deeper.
Mm-hmm.
Either it's deeper in the Sfirot, but suddenly you start to talk from Malchut, you understand that he talks about Tiferet, and then about Binah, either like that, or that suddenly you really understand that the meaning that the younger person of the Chabura gave something, but then you know somebody else will give you more.
Mm-hmm.
And the more that you are a sensitive reader, you get it. You get that you have a deeper interpretation, and usually the end of it will be with Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai, the main teacher. And what does he do when he's here and the drasha? He actually collects the different parts of the drashot and he puts them together. Here it's like, it actually needs to be shown like a cornice, but there is some right three dimensions. But here it actually holds everybody.
Mm-hmm.
And usually the way that they get, when you see it, and it's very beautiful to see the whole homiletic, Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai will tell each person when they have gatherings like that. They have gatherings that when all of them talks, it's really beautiful to see it. So Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai tells one of the students, Kum, stand up, but Kum, it's also Yikum. It says, Kum, Amod, Bekiyumcha. He tells him, stand. Kum, Amod, but Amod is also Amud,
right.
A pillar. Amud. Kum,
mm-hmm.
Amud, a pillar in your essence. Kum,
mm-hmm.
Yekum.
Okay, but what does he say?
When
what does he say to someone?
Kum, stand, Amud, which is also Amud, the
mm-hmm.
pillar, Bekiyumcha, in your essence. So each person who gives
your what?
Essence.
And what does he mean?
He tells that each person of the Chavura, of when he gives in the homiletic, his drasha, he really needs to give something from his own soul.
Mm-hmm.
And it's beautiful to see it because they don't put away any one of them. It's always like that. It's a spiralic movement. very, very different from the Talmud. And this is why the Zohar really is, I think, giving a lot of criticism to the story of the Talmud. Because if you will see the main big stories of the Talmud, I just taught it this year. It was fascinating for me to see it. I'm very lucky that in the yeshiva, we decided that we don't teach Zohar to the younger students. So I teach Bible and I teach Talmud. It's so much fun. So you see the big stories, Rabbi Shimon Barim, Rabbi Shimon, Rabbi Resh Lakish, Rabbi Yochanan. Like the big stories are always about conflicts.
Yes.
And always somebody dies in the end. They die and die and die. It's really so, it's sad to see that the conflicts always some, like Rabbi Akiva and Rabbi Eliezer. What? Yeah. And in the Zohar, you don't see it. You don't see, they don't, they really, I think they have an inner criticism about all this shakla and taria and conflict in the Talmud, and they try to do something like that.
But in the end, they reach the same point, like the Rambam and the Zohar. We both get to the, you can't say anything about it. Because the Talmud reduces and reduces and reduces until you can't disprove. So it's also a negative theology. So if you can't disprove it, then that's the accepted.
Yeah, but it's
but
very.
But doesn't mean it can't be disproved in the future.
It's but still, it's very different to say no, 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 no.
Oh, psychologically.
And to say yes. Completely different.
Yeah, but they get to the same point.
It's yeah, but it's a, the, yeah. But the road is completely different. Yeah. What happens to you in
no,
the road?
No, the temperament and the psychology of it. Yes, the emotion. Yes.
Very, very different. And to say this is not exactly enough. This is not enough. No, 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 no. It's different than saying yes, 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 and yes, and yes, and in and you do have development in this yes.
But the problem is, if you constantly say yes, you're saying yes to a lot of crap too. That's a problem.
It is a problem. But saying no, you also say no to a lot of
good
things. So you're right, right. So okay. So let's go back here. So let's go to. So we said to awaken love. So Cher, do you want to read or do you want
to?
Carol. So it is.
So it is with the word of Yehovah. She reveals herself to no one but her lover. I was kept raising my hand and I wanted to say.
Sorry, so say.
It seems to me, I mean, this might be, I'm very, very stupid, that this is really like the whole essence of the relationship between, or the place of women, or the relationship of men and women with the Torah being woman and modesty. And always keeping yourself covered up and only revealing yourself to the one and only who would be your husband if it were a literal. If you wanted to take this literally, and that to the rest of the world you're supposed to be covered, and it almost it's a Torah is the wife, and the rest and the lover is it would be her husband, and that it has to be this way. She can't be exposed to everybody and available to everybody. That would be totally. In opposition to what the place of a woman would be is in Judaism. You're not supposed to be available. You're not supposed to be there for everybody to look and to see and to glance and to be revealed to everybody. And you're supposed to keep yourself. No one who is there knows or reflects. He alone does. And his heart and soul and everything within him flows out to her. And it's a one-on-one relationship. It's not for the tzibur or rachav to see women and to see this Torah. This is a one-to-one relationship.
I'm sure you're right.
And it's not for public consumption. At least not lova
kohesa. Vodashel bat melech nima. We know this very, very famous phrase that the kavod, the honor, or the glory of the bat melech. It's only it's pnima, it's inside.
And even with women who wear wigs, at home they take it off. And the modern, you know, the fact that your hair, the beautiful, your crowning glory is supposed to be hidden from other people. And only when you're home and with your husband are you supposed to take it off unless I'm mistaken.
But that's the Torah. But what I see is when you pray deep from your heart and your soul, you are giving that to the Torah and you are revealing the secrets of the inner you. And only He will know your thoughts, your deep, and your intention. So this is your secret of life. This is your secret, and this is your one-on-one relationship.
But what I'm saying about Torah is that she's a tease. She has a lot more power than women have in Judaism. They view women here, from what we see here, they view women as being extremely, as having all of the power, actually. Because she's the one who's beckoning to him, and she's the one who's sitting there and arousing him. And she's doing it purposely. She's not trying to be Tzmua. She's trying to get him interested. And so that's very interesting in terms of the way these men view women. They view women as having a lot of power. And if you look further, which you might go past, you'll see that she's the one who's calling the shots.
Right. So I don't know.
No, but that's interesting because that's not the way women work. Women were not empowered, and here they are empowered.
The way women are.
That's not the way
women
are.
Can I throw it in there, please? If the Torah is represented by a woman, and she is trying to draw and reveal herself to a man, how does a woman approach the Torah?
You asked me?
Yes.
You're asking a very, very, very important and being asked a lot about the gender issue in the Zohar. I mean, is it, the Zohar is chauvinist, feminist, none of it? Is it an agonistic way to look at it? How do I treat it as a woman reading Torah? It was written for sure by men, so how men in the 13th century.
So sure
we don't know. We do have the woman of Moshe de Leon who said no, but we really don't know. But some of it probably was written by men. So it's a very, very, very interesting, and it's a lot of people also wrote about it. It's so interesting in so many ways. One of the ways to look at it that we know that the Kabbalistic people that wrote books that are parallel to the Zohar, and that the researchers thought that they part of the members of the group, the Chavura, who wrote the Zohar, testify about themselves that they see themselves as the wives of God. Which is a very, very interesting way to look at yourself as a woman. I'm the wife. Because if they see themselves as Malchut, right? It's Sfirat Malchut.
It's like Catholic nuns who marry Jesus.
Yeah, they are. So it's there, and so if we are the garden, we are Malchut. And we want to be open to God, so we need to know how to be empty, and we need to know how to have the experience of the womb, of that, like of. And I want to know what does that mean to be a feminine. So there are maybe not first, but when we're talking about men who are exploring their feminine side. So and it's okay. I teach many students who are just we have a lot of laugh about it, but for the Kabbalistic that was very you know the spiritual path to really understand what does that mean to be Malchut. It's actually to understand what does that mean to be feminine, and most of the Zohar. The name of the series was the rose, the deer, the expression of the feminine side of Malchut, Shekhinah, and I did something different because I thought that it's for people who already had introduction to the Zohar. But anyhow, why is it they, the people who wrote it? Most of the Zohar is about Sfirat Melchut and about understanding feminine. If women would write it, maybe they would write different, but it's still very, very interesting to see men trying to explore the feminine side. And for me as a woman, read it, it's for many, many, I find myself identified with a lot of the things they write.
How are women mentioned in the Zohar besides as the Torah?
All the time. The
women, no, but as what?
The mother, Em Eliona, Em Tachtona, Bina, Em Malchut. The Torah is feminine. The rose. We didn't read the story about the Ayala, the deer, a very, very important figure in the Zohar, who is in many, many, many different symbols. And also they explore Rachel, the mother Rachel is very important, Leah, Sarah. Mm-hmm. And when they talk about David, David HaMelech, they saw the David, what they were interested in David was more his poetic side.
His what?
The David HaMeshorer. Then right. The poetic side, then and the artistic side, then the warrior.
Right.
They are interested in David who writes psalms. We know that he didn't write it, but in their mind, David wrote psalms. Who Mishorer shel Elohim, here the poet of God, and they're totally in love with that side. So for them, this is all expression of femininity, and they just want to, you know, dive into it and understand it. So for them, I don't want to say woman, feminine is very, 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 very important.
It's like in Christianity that they made Mary, the whole theology around Mary.
Right, but today we see all kind of women do circle of women to empower women to understand the feminine language. I share it a lot, you know, that you have women gather themselves together and talking about, let's have the expression of the feminine voice in the you know, kolech or different. But for them, it wasn't something that women should do, human being should do. It wasn't migdar, it wasn't something of gender.
No, because women weren't considered even worthy of study.
But one of the things that is interesting, how did they know so much about femininity? They had to learn from someone. So I don't know, I don't know if they really talk to their wives or not, and how they treat their wives. I don't know, because we don't have any kind of testimonies about it. And we know that there were men in the 13th century, so we have to understand that there were men in the 13th century. The only thing that I do know from the text, that they're very, very, very interested. I don't think in feminine. I don't think they were feminist. That was something that was not in their mind. It's not their concept of life to be a feminist. This is something that we deal with. It's not the question they asked. They do ask the question of feminism. And this is something very interesting because we're talking about the 13th century. Very, very old. Yes.
I often thought that if Freud was a woman, she would have written about uterus envy, not penis envy. That subconsciously men are jealous of women because they can give birth, they can make life, and men can't.
Interesting.
So what I'm thinking here is there's a whole psychological thing going on here. As civilization advances and culture advances and people get a little more sensitive to the other, and maybe there was a period where people began looking at their wives not just as property like a camel or a donkey, but as another human being. And
maybe we just don't have any kind of, we don't know. We all, the only thing we know. Here, so let's continue.
Can I turn the Mazgan down?
Yes, me sure.
Come and see this if you want to begin. So it is with the Torah, with the word of Torah. She reveals her to no one but her lover. Torah knows that he who is wise of heart hovers about her gate every day. What does she do? She reveals her face to him from the palace and beckons him with a hint. Then swiftly withdraws to her hiding place. No one knows. No one who is there knows or reflects. He alone does. And his heart and his soul and everything within him flows out to her. That is why Hira reveals and conceals herself. With love, she approaches her lover to arouse him with love. Come and see. This is the way of
Hira. To arouse love.
Yeah, we'll deal with the hint in a minute, but let's continue a little bit because we don't...
Come and see, this is the way of Torah. At first, when she begins to reveal herself to a human, she beckons him with a hint. If he knows, good. If not, she sends him a message, calling him a fool. Torah says to her messenger, tell that fool to come... tell that fool to come closer so I can talk with him, as it is written. Who is the fool without a heart? Have him turn in here. He approaches. She begins to speak to him from behind the curtain which she has drawn, words he can follow, until he reflects a little at that time. This is Derasha. Then she converses with him through a thin veil, words riddled with allegory. This is Haggadah. Once he has grown accustomed to her, she reveals herself face to face and tells him all her secrets, all the hidden ways, some primordial since primordial days secreted in her heart. Now he is a perfect human being, husband of Torah, master of the house. All her secrets she has revealed to him, withholding nothing, concealing nothing.
More?
Yes.
Never
finish it off.
Okay. She says to him, do you see that word, that hint with which I beckoned you at first? So many secrets there, this one and that one. Now he sees that nothing should be added to those words and nothing taken away. Now that shock of the verse, just like it is, not even a single letter should be added or deleted. Human beings must become aware. They must pursue Torah to become her lovers.
Oh,
that's the moral of the story.
I wonder how do you say shock in English?
Shock?
Simple meaning.
It's a simple meaning, yes.
What yeah, but he, a shat in Hebrew is pashut, which is
simple.
But it's also
basic. That's good. Basic.
Uncovered. Yes. With pashut in Hebrew, it's simple, but it's also
short.
Yes, uncovered.
Pashut, right.
Okay.
Pashut is also right. Is simple, right. But if short, it's also to uncover. It's
undressed.
Yes.
So this is why I say I don't know what to write here.
Yes, right. You didn't know
because
all
I didn't
of them. Undress, uncover,
all of the above.
I think it's to leave it with more than one meaning or allow an interpretation. Because the minute he would, whoever wrote it,
if he would translate
Pshat, then it would give it one meaning.
Wasn't the last one so?
Leave it in as shut, then you're leaving the interpretation.
Or
the translation.
Part of this.
He interpreted, then becomes accepted.
Is there a relationship also erotic?
What?
Wait a minute. What? So. From now the Zohar, from, you know, we talked about, you know, we were in a legendary story about, you know, a beautiful princess in the tower, and she's doing all these things, and they write, and suddenly when we continue with the story, we see that they're actually also not only and you see yes, not only talking about homiletics. And about way to understand the Torah, and how can you understand more and more meanings in the Torah? And the Torah that tries to draw us in to different meanings, and we'll also try to understand why doesn't the Torah gives us a secret immediately, or the pshat? And it's very, very also interesting to understand what. Is the general, who are they talking with? The context of it. So we know that we have Rashi and we know that we have Parades.
Parades,
you know the word Parades?
Yes.
Orchard.
Orchard.
Oh, yeah.
Orchard. Okay, so the Parades is orchard is a very symbolic word in the Talmud. We know that in Masechet Chagigah, which is the most mystical Masechet in the Talmud. How do you say Masechet?
Tractate.
In the Talmud, we have a story about four people
who entered the
Parades, Rabbi Akiva, Rabbi Azai, Ben Zoma, and the other, Acher. And it's a very, very, very famous story about four people who entered an orchard, and only one of them came back with peace. Nichnas b'shalom v'yatza b'shalom. Rabbi Akiva. All the other either died or went crazy or became apikoresh. Right, so, and it's one of the most, the story of Mechonini that really created a lot of impact on Jewish philosophy and mysticism. Four people who entered the orchard, if you, like, it's one of the most important stories about trying to understand something about the mystery, about God. And only one of them right, and just came back with peace, Rabbi Akiva, who is also known as a mystical figure of the Talmud, that in contrast to his in contrast to Rabbi Ishmael, who was his peer, Rabbi Ishmael always was saying the pshat, the literal meaning, and Rabbi Akiva, we know about him that he always every letter he knew to say 100 secrets about each letter. He was really Ish Haggadah, legendary person, not Pshat. And but so that's the orchard for this, and the rabbis taught us that this orchard is not just trees, it's actually ways of understanding the Torah, that part of this pay is for Pshat, for the literal meaning, literal, Reish is for the hint, for the remez, for the
secret,
for nothing.
No. Well,
remez, it's just a hint, it's not yet the secret. Dalet is drash, is a, you know, a deeper meaning to the pshat, pshat and drash, and samech is for the secret, for the sod. And Rashi, if you know the way that Rashi always interpreted the Torah, it always tells us the pshat meaning of it is this and this and this, and the drash meaning of it is something different. Mm-hmm. He always tried to tell us that this is the literal meaning of something, but you should know that there is also a different meaning that is different from the pshat. So this is the context of it. So Zohar is dialoguing with it and says, you know what, I have my own Parades, but I'm doing something different here. Let's see what they're doing. The first thing that, that the Torah does is doing a hint. Mm-hmm. How do I understand it? What is this hint?
She beckons you.
Something that's not clear from the text. It beckons you to try and understand more.
There she is.
There she is.
Yeah.
Okay. So
it's something like if you read the context of that we read last week from Joseph von Schnorfer.
Right.
There's all kinds of things that seem not to make a lot of sense. And raising those kinds of issues by saying things in different ways, it beckons you to come inside and examine and look for more.
Beautiful. So the way you understand it, it's a hint, it's a question that arises in you.
Right.
That if something you have, suddenly you have a question, hey, something here is not clear to me, what's going on here, why is it like that, I'm starting on a journey. Every time that I have something that is not clear, that it's actually some kind of paradox, some kind of a...
It's also very a subtlety that she did. Because it says, if it's not clear, basically, which says, she'll send that idiot another message that's more clear. The fool, she calls him a fool.
Yeah.
But she'll send him another one that's more. If he gets it good, if not, I'll send him another thing.
Some more,
he's not very bright.
Right, so I have to put more and more stumbling blocks. Right, right. But we see here.
If he knows, good.
Yeah, if he knows, good. If not, I'll have to. And she calls him a fool.
Right. I remember that once I was. When I was younger and I didn't have two little children, I was traveling a lot to India all the time, and I was staying a lot in one street in India that I loved. And one day a group of six Israelis came, and I was, I think, 25 or 26, something like that, and they were 55 to 60, and they came to see what are their children looking in India. Why are they coming here? Because you know that all the Israelis are going to India.
That's interesting.
And they were like, okay, we'll come to India and we'll try to figure it out. Why are our children are coming here? And they sat with me and they saw that I'm nice, and they were like, okay, so can you explain me? You look pretty intelligent, and like, why are you coming here? And I was like, okay, I can give them a whole monologue. And they were asking me how many times I'm here. And I said, oh, I think this is my fourth time in India, and I'm spending in this street, I think, 3 weeks it was. And they were like, 3 weeks in that street? It was, you know, a pretty short street. In Rishikesh. And... So they tell me, what are you doing here? And I said, okay, give them a whole monologue, or I will send them to some kind of a journey. And I said, you know what, let's meet here in an hour. Just, you know, go back and forth in the street and tell me what you see and what is weird in your eyes. And they were coming back after an hour, and they were like really annoyed, and they said, well, we were traveling in this small street and we didn't see anything that, you know, I don't know what you're looking here. It's dirty and it's messy, and okay, we saw this temple and this, that temple and that temple. Okay, so I asked them, okay, so, but what is weird in your eyes? What is weird? And what raising questions in you? So they're starting to talk, and they say, okay, so why do they have cows in the street? And why does women cover themselves with all kind of different colors? And why is this nun, or this, it's not nun, it's a religious person dressed that way, and the other way dressed the other way? And why all the temples doesn't look the same, and what are the different gods here that they see, and why does people pray to God? And suddenly they were all intrigued with all these different, very, very different questions. But was suddenly the street was full of unclear things to them that they could, and I said, you know, because of all of these questions, that nothing looks like the way I see the world. It's all so different from how I vision life and I was taught to look about life. It's so different. So I'm just, you know, all the time in a question mode. And so this is about questioning. You know, the hint is a question is a beautiful way to start a journey. The things are not clear to me. But I have to ask, why is it like that? Or not why is like Lama Zekoeli, but what, you know, the deeper why. What's really happening here? So it's really, I think it's a very, very important. So the hint is, you say, come here. What's, you know, what's weird? Here, what else? do you see about the hint? What's the hint?
What was the question?
What's the hint?
She reveals herself, and then she, just for a second, she piques his interest, she gets his interest, and then she covers it up.
That's a tease.
Well, that's what she does. To awaken love in him.
So the hint is an emotion?
It says she reveals her face to him from the palace and beckons him with a hint, then swiftly withdraws to her hiding place. Yeah, I think she makes him question something, makes him curious about something.
So the hint is about arising.
It's a choice of words is a hint. It's also a choice of words that you use. I was just thinking about the, I think it's from the Tehillim. It says, Firim Rashu Vara'im, or Torsei Adonai. Torsei Adonai, Shachati Adiyan, I said in this. Firim Rashu Vara'im, or Torsei Adonai, Lo Yasaru Kotov.
Lo Yasaru Kotov, right.
And what's the meaning of it? What it basically says is that lions sinned, and they went hungry. But those who are seeking God, everything will be fine. They'll get it all. Now, what the hell is lions in that sentence? What's the parallel between lions and those who seek God? They're parallel, but they don't make sense. So the choice of the word kfirim raises a serious question. What the hell is it mean?
What are they doing here? And then you write, and when you have it, that's you might go to Shimshon, or you might go to Olga, and you will start looking.
Right, because there's a choice of words is interesting. The fact is, it could be a mistake. It could be kofrim.
Could be, which is also very interesting, right? It could be kofrim. I never thought about it, but it could be.
Kofrim Rashul Vara'evu, as I said in the Lo Yasaru.
Right. In the question is the hint. And the question is the beginning of the seeking and the longing and the play between
beautiful
the veiled and the unveiled.
So it's not only just a question, what's going on here. It's also when you listen to the question, you start to have the answer. The question leads you to some kind of direction, which is very interesting because, right, what is the question? Is it why, where, right? Whatever you will ask will also lead you.
Look what happened to the people. All of a sudden they came back, reported that all they saw was dirt and this and great chaos. And then...
Who said this?
The Israeli parents who tried to seek Moshe. And all of a sudden asking the question, what was being revealed, the hints that were being revealed, is that there was more than that. There was so much going on.
Right.
Well, that's like Moshe and the 12 spies. Ten came back with... All 12 saw the same thing, and each came back with different understandings. So.
And if we'll go back to the chapter that we learned in the Torah,
right.
Moses starts with a question. Show me your face. I want to understand why are you interacting with us in that way? Right? You want to, kill us, everybody, and make me the first... And I want really to understand you. And I want to know you. And who are you? Right?
But there's no word for this.
It's a soon
there's no word for this.
Right. Soon she will tell me, Pshat. Soon she will say, soon I will tell you that I'm Pshat.
The language itself is limited. That's the point.
Limited for sure. So we start with a hint.
Right.
And then she tells him, you know what? After the hint, right, he approaches and she begins to speak to him behind the curtain which she has drawn, words he can follow, until he reflects a little at a time. This is Rasha.
Yep.
First,
it's founded on the Shah.
It's not the Shah in the Zohar, it's the Drash. What you see, the literal meaning, what you think it's just the literal meaning, for them,
it's just the words that you can understand. It's only a drasha. It's lidrosh, which is to demand, but it's also to seek. Doshe Adonai, the people who are seeking God. So after you start with hints and questions, you have all kinds of beginning of seeking, drashot. This is only, you know,
maybe will be what we talked about, the stories or the curtains, words for you. That will be the drashot, seeking God. And after that will be the allegory, the Haggadah,
which is, and I'm starting, now I'm starting to speed up because I see I have only 15 minutes, okay? To this class. So, Haggadah, the way that they translate here is allegory, which this time I pretty agree with the translation, because they're dialoguing with the Rambam, and they're dialoguing with this whole words of symbols and allegories, that, you know, that we talk about God in all kind of symbols. And what I taught you about the Sefirot, it's also symbols. It's symbols. And if we talk about faces of God, Panim, we actually believe that God has no face, as you said. So it's symbols. It's all allegories. It's not this, but it's a reflection of something. It's not that we can jump over them or be without them. The Zohar doesn't talk to us like the Rambam, who tells us nothing is God. This is not God, and this is not God, and this is not God, and this is not God. And you cannot see God, so let's not even try. Let's be completely abstract. No. He is putting himself, or the he, or whoever, or they, put himself as the seekers of God, as Moses. And they want to see the face of God. But they know that they cannot completely see the face of God. But that doesn't mean that they don't see the face of God.
That doesn't mean that
they don't see the face of God. They do and they don't. Like what we saw here, that Moshe yedaber el Adonai, he talks to God panim el panim, and then panai lo yireu, and we see that in the same chapter it contradicts itself. And we keep seeing that there is something between seeing the face and not seeing the face. Seeing the face and not seeing the face. We see it here also. I keep wanting and wishing to see the face of something, of the Torah, of God.
Is that desire not blasphemous?
What? Right?
No, the desire is not blasphemous. What?
Why would it be
to have the search to see the truth?
The truth?
Or the essence of God is a legitimate search. Unfortunately, though, you never get to see it. But the search is what keeps us going.
He says they must pursue Torah to become her lovers. He says it's by the way,
and this thing that we heard from about Leibovitz yesterday, mm-hmm. I just lost it. They asked him, do you believe in the coming of the Messiah? And he right. said, yes, I believe.
He's becoming.
He said, Yavo HaMashiach.
That's right.
He will
Shehu Yavo. Yavo.
No.
Yavo, Yavo, and we'll always keep believing Shehu Yavo.
So the Messiah is a state of becoming.
And the desire.
And if the Messiah is here, then you know that he or she is a false. Is not.
It's okay. It's okay to see.
Well done. Well done.
You know what the Zohar interpretation to the Messiah?
Yeah. No.
Messiah.
Oh.
Messiah.
From the word siach. Siach is conversation.
So, yes.
I would also put yes. Messiah.
That's beautiful.
No.
Confusion.
I know. Yes.
No, no.
Messiah as in siach.
Siach. Messiah,
but you're
saying it's Messiah.
Okay.
And Siach.
Okay, Siach, so that's the conversation.
Messiah.
From
the converse.
The dialogue.
That's beautiful.
That yes. God is keep, that God is keep trying to talk to us through reality,
right.
Through something. And it's not over there.
It's
over
right,
here,
right here,
but exactly oh, sure. Like Olam Haba, that right. The Olam Haba that keeps coming, okay. It keeps talking to you.
Yeah.
It's not a person.
No,
right.
It's a revolution.
Yeah.
It's an interaction.
It's a discussion.
And it's either you've been able. It is either you've been able to, exactly like here, to listen, to turn your head.
What
did right Rambam, interact.
What does Rambam say about Mashiach? What's his?
Herzl would be the Mashiach for him. He was a man of
God. No,
but...
I think he does talk about it. Like, when he talks about Mashiach, it's about a political entity.
Mm. It's the Jews coming back to London.
That's what Levin yeah. said. Mentioned.
And about times of independence and times of where the temple will be built, because we will be able to build it and we will be able to control the land again. And and it's when he talks about Mashiach, it's in Hilchot Medina. But in terms of the Zohar, it's always in the Zohar, it's always consciousness, and it's always like at the Mikdash Adam, like we are the temple,
mm-hmm.
And the, and Mashiach is a consciousness here.
I wanted to ask you. You wrote that the last. Of the levels, the deepest is the pshat in the Zohar, whereas what we would say and what was the Talmud, the pshat is the surface, and here it's so. Can you?
So because pshat in Hebrew has two meanings, pashut, mm-hmm. which is simple, but pashut is also abstract. Also without clothes, is the most intimate interaction. Lehit Pashet is to be uncovered, to reveal.
It's yeah, but the way it's written here, now the shot of the verse, just like it is, not even a single letter should be added or deleted. So, it's saying, you must take it as it's written, and that's the holy, that's the holiness, that's the secret. Reminds me of somebody that you talked about. Who was it? The Sfaradim, when they study Kabbalah, or you were saying that they don't delve into it, but it's like an emotional thing that uplifts.
Right.
So that's the way it seems here. That's
it has to do also with that you accept things as they are. But I think that in many, many different religions, they talk about two stages of the naivety or tmimut, of looking at things as they are. When you're a baby and you look at things as they are and you just accept them. Right? And this is it. And then questions start to rise up. Why is it like that? Why is it like that? And you start to break reality and look for meanings and look for meanings. And in the end, the paradox also again needs to bring you back to a place of like, okay, no meaning will actually hold all of it. And there is no explanation that will be big enough, wide enough, complex enough to explain me reality as it is, and I have to go back to this pursuit. Okay, this is it. But it's from now what you do, it's from a different place. It's not, okay, this is it without all, it doesn't contradict or
cancel
the road. it doesn't say all what you searched for was meaningless, yes. Like you were looking for the truth, and now you have to say, okay, either there is no truth or the truth is so paradox that I have to accept it as that wide. Here you see the whole journey that this pshat, you start from little, and you ask, what is it? And then you get to pashut, which is without the clothes.
There's something here that's even more interesting. He becomes a whole person, a perfect person, having understanding all of the secrets. And yet, at the end, he sees that nothing can be taken away and nothing can be added to it.
Right.
He understands all the secrets, and then he comes to that understanding.
To the understanding that if this is it, it's not simple meaning, it's the whole meaning.
Yeah, but it's also without, in modern terms I would say without pseudo-intellectual falsanut. It's like, that's what it is, you don't have to go around this and that.
Yeah,
but it's only after, it's only after,
you have to do it.
It's all, you can't reach it, you can't reach it because, so maybe here in these 5 minutes, we can understand something that is, for me, very, very important. We're talking about authentic consciousness, and we're talking about you can't fake it. You can't say, okay, this is it in a real consciousness of shalom with it, if you're not there,
mm-hmm.
if you didn't do the whole road of searching.
You
didn't do the whole road of searching, questioning God, questioning yourself, being the seekers, looking for answering, dealing with different methods and drashot and allegories and looking for meaning and do all that. But by the end of it, you will have to be with a pshat.
By being extremely sophisticated and by being extremely aware can you end up going to the understanding.
Really understanding.
Yeah. To understanding the basics.
That's right.
And
for
right, and so many times I think I know it from myself and from people. We want to let go of the road. Okay, let's let go. Let's not, and it's not happening. And the questions and the hints and the allegories and the search are there, and we're not in like this is it. We're not there. And if we're talking about interaction between people, how many times we are wishing that people will accept us as we are, and we want to accept people
mm-hmm.
as they are, and how many times we have to do such a road to be in this kind of relationship?
Mm-hmm.
We're not there. We have to do a long, long search journey with our children, with our partners, with our colleagues, with our Israelis, with Jews, with universe.
Yeah.
With like right, we have to do the journey
for ourselves.
Of that, the journey tells us in the end, right? The journey with ourselves for sure, and in the journey that we keep, working and searching. A lot of it is also, the pshat, except it. And this doesn't.
The name of God.
This doesn't cancel the road, the work, or the road. The lover of the Torah, which now we know that the Torah is not only text, needs to do the road all the time.
Well, it's more like coming full circle rather than going in a straight line. We've just come full circle and done the work along the way. It's not just...
deeper understanding.
Right.
That's the way it works. Whether
right.
you consider it a spiral or coming right. full circle or whatever.
And you have, and it's not only a circle that is, just going round
no.
and round and round. It's a spiral. You're going from hint to glash to allegories. You're searching and you're searching and you're searching. In the end, you get to pshat. But this pshat has to be really inspiring for you. Not like, why did I reach in the end? It has to be the secret of God, of Torah, of love. Yes.
I always understood that four people entering into paradise and only one that he was surviving. I've understood the word pardes, not in the way, not in this, as you've explained it here today, which is Paris Valley's son. But pardes was entering into an attempt to see the face of God. in other words, enter into paradise. Rather than pardes.
Right.
And paradise comes from pardes, yeah. And in a sense, anybody who really goes into Zohar or Kabbalah runs the risk of going crazy, of seeing God's face. So that's a different way of understanding that story. And that's why we're warned not to study Zohar and Kabbalah until you're at the age of Rabbi Akiva, who was 40. So it's a different I had a different understanding.
Right, right. But here, from the homiletic, you can see that they do.
Yes, no, I know that. That's.
But Lee, it's and. It's not either.
Right.
Yeah,
right.
That's true, yeah.
So
this is a different conception.
So thank you. I want to thank you. You were very stimulating group. It was fun meeting you. Thank you.